Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. The latest news out of the American Journal of Public Health finds that we've effectively lost the battle of the bulge. Listen to this. The probability of obese people returning to a normal weight, they say, and staying there is 1%. Who knows? Maybe there's hope for kids who won't take the threat of obesity sitting down, as some schools consider outfitting their classrooms with standing desks. Joining us on the line to take on these and other medical headlines is Art Kaplan. Art is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Lingo Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hey there, Art.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Hi, Art. Well, I read this piece, and they accepted, as they pointed out, people that get the bariatric surgery. They weren't in the study, but I read this piece and thought, this is really depressing news for people that are trying hard and doing the right thing and going on diets and exercising like mad. What's the takeaway?
Well, it's worse than that. Not only don't we know how to get people to lose weight and keep it off, in the current reimbursement atmosphere environment, we're starting to say to people, hey, you can't get a procedure unless you lose weight. And what I mean is things like hip replacements or knee replacements. We're starting to see bundled payments or fixed reimbursement. So the surgeons, the orthopedic guys say, well, you're pretty high risk if you're obese and I'm going to try and replace your hip. So you got to lose weight in order for me to do this operation on you. And if we don't know how to get people to lose weight, we're asking them to do something probably they can't do.
Yeah, but my understanding, are, and I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, is what this study suggests and what I've always thought, even pre this study or publication, the issue has never been the ability of people to lose weight temporarily. I've done it about 1,000 times in my life. The issue is the ability to maintain that healthier weight, and that's what they're focused on, right, is the notion you may get there, but you can't stay there.
Well, even in the orthopedic situation, they say, you've got a year before we'll do this, so get it off and keep it off.
Oh, I got it. Okay.
Boy, I don't know. I'm not sure that happens. Yep, each of us can go on a diet right after New Year's, lose 5 pounds and feel pretty good about ourselves. It's just that by the time the next new year comes, we're 6 pounds heavier.
So Art Kaplan, you know, we all remember, at least I remember when I was little, almost nobody was fat. And so I guess...
Because you didn't know me.
Well, I didn't know. But I mean, the heavy
Well, that's
kid,
because we were all walking to school
playing outside. I mean, you remember the kids and there were only, you know, in a class of 25, maybe 2 or 3 kids that were heavy. Everybody else was kind of, you know, normal weight or even skinny. So I guess this almost means we need like a revolution that starts when babies are barely born and how we are eating from the time kids are tiny.
So I think that's true. I think we do have a lot more couch potato behavior. I was sort of sneering at the 5-mile walk, but I think we were outside more, playing outside, doing more things as kids that were physical activity. I think you know, we're kind of locked into our TVs and our internet and our video games. So that really is taking a toll. We don't move enough. I think also there's a problem in terms of weight. I still believe we're pushing fat, bigger portions and fattier foods at folks. I just don't remember. Well, first of all, I don't remember eating out much when I was a kid, but when we went out, I don't think they served me a steak the size of, you know,
Iowa.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Art, can I get back to the study for a minute? Since you haven't contradicted its findings, I'm assuming you agree with this 1% thing. And if the 1% thing is true, essentially what the message is this is totally hopeless.
Yeah, exactly.
Is that not the message?
Well, it's at least in need of a lot more work than we're putting into it. So I think this is a top priority to get better ideas about how to lose weight, or is surgery the answer, or can we come up with medications, or what? I wouldn't give up. I would just say right now, we don't know what we're doing. By the way, it also gets into the weight loss industry side. Do they keep the weight off? You know, the folks who are on TV saying, buy our products, you can eat pizza and brownies just in microscopic portions and all that sort of thing. It doesn't make you feel like anybody knows really how to keep weight off. Temporary loss, yeah. Long term, it just doesn't seem to be out there yet.
Well, you know, one last thing, and I should have looked up the name of this television show, and I didn't, but my daughter was watching this, and I sat down with her and watched it too. There's this TV show that focuses in on people that are like 700 pounds. They are enormous. Mm-hmm. They are so heavy that they're in wheelchairs and they sit in their homes and they just eat. And you think, this is obviously a mental illness or something, but apparently there's enough of these people that they've got dozens of them lined up to do this TV show. So this is another kind of weird thing that's going on.
Right. So the sort of morbidly obese, way off the scale, that never really existed much before either, and we see more of it. It's not a big group, but at the far extreme, it's telling you that something's wrong culturally, something's wrong in terms of the food message. I'm not even sure that the TV show, in a way, I know they're saying, you know, we're going to help you and you're going to lose weight and we're going to do this and that, but there's a certain kind of, indulgence in this person's gluttony and the consequences thereof. I'm not sure it ought to be entertainment quite that way.
Oh, it's nauseating. It's nauseating. I'm a disgraceful mother for allowing her to watch it.
You know, one last thing about this.
Turn over to Housewives of Atlanta.
That's right.
You know, I mentioned this in the open as I was introducing you, Art. I mean, a lot of schools are buying these desks that you can adjust to stand. I don't know if you know, since you've never been in studio with us, we stand during this show. We don't stand for health reasons. We stand for...
I thought you were standing at attention.
For energy reasons, but I am a huge advocate that whatever healthier habit you can teach a young kid, the likelihood is good that they're going to continue that habit later into life. So while it may be a small piece of the, I was going to say pie, a poor choice of words, a small piece of the solution, that's not a horrible idea, is it?
No, and there are even desks that have, I've seen them now coming with... you can walk a little bit at the desk, like a treadmill kind of thing.
Oh, yeah, we're going to talk about that with our listeners in a while. Absolutely.
Yeah, so I don't mind those. That's good. I still think, though, just putting back recess would be nice, having phys ed return
Absolutely.
To the pool, have more sports for kids, both in elementary, high school, and college, you know, those who aren't the superstars. We have this weird, we love sports, but we only apparently love it played by the top 1/1,000th of 1% of people.
We're talking to Art Kaplan from NYU's Langone Medical Center. You know, Art, I heard you as I'm driving in my car last night. I'm not supposed to acknowledge I ever listen to anything other than 89.7, which is mostly the truth. I'm actually listening to the radio broadcast of the CBS Evening News with Charlie Rose sitting in. And you were on, and you were commenting upon an issue. That, well, actually, you should describe it, Marjorie.
Well, this is this contretemps that's surrounding Planned Parenthood right now. There's this pro-life group that secretly has taped a couple of videos at Planned Parenthood. And the one that's gotten the most traction is of a doctor, Mary Gator. She's a physician with Planned Parenthood talking while she's eating lunch and drinking wine here's the controversy. They're claiming that the Planned Parenthood is selling fetal tissue. Planned Parenthood says that they, which is illegal, they are saying that they are donating this for medical research. But what is really upsetting, even to those of us who are pro-choice, is listening to this doctor in a rather kind of heartless and just matter-of-fact way, like she's talking about changing a tire, talking about how she's preserving certain organs in an aborted fetus to be donated and crunching above and below the liver so that they can save the liver. And, this was very hard stuff to watch. All right, what's your take on it?
Well, let me start by saying I'm a pro-choice person. I support the availability of abortion through Planned Parenthood. I think the ethics of each individual choice to have an abortion are debatable, and we can argue about good reasons and bad reasons, and I understand the complexity of that whole issue. All that said, I've watched the tapes, and what I think is this. I think I know the tapes are a sting, and I know they're set up by a group that wants to go after Planned Parenthood and get them defunded, and the real goal there is to close those clinics. It's not to make fetal tissue donation better.
Right.
You know, they don't really care about that, or they wish there were no tissues to donate. All that said, I'm really bothered by these tapes, even if they're edited and things are put in a bad light. You know, I'll run through it. Why are we in a restaurant having this discussion? Shouldn't this be in a conference room?
Exactly.
Why are they out in a public place doing this? Why isn't their lawyer there? You know, not just the medical person, but somebody who can say, this is our policy, this is what we do. The people who are trying to sting Planned Parenthood are saying, well, you're selling baby parts. Now, look, they're not doing that. They're charging fees for handling the tissue, identifying parts in the remains, storing them, shipping them, that sort of business. And the fees are modest. But on the tape, you see them haggle about the fee.
Right.
Can't do that. You got to have like a fixed fee. You know, you don't sit there and say, well, what are you willing to pay? Because that opens the door to precisely the charge that they don't want to get involved with, which is selling as opposed to just getting reimbursed for the cost of the service. Biggest problem I saw there is that, and you mentioned it, Marjorie, it's changing the abortion technique to get certain kinds of tissues.
Right.
Big, big ethical no-no. I think I first got into this whole issue back in the late 80s. Fetal tissue was the hot thing. We hadn't discovered stem cells. We weren't having all these fights about embryonic stem cells. And we wrote a paper and we said, look, if you're going to do this, you can't change the technique. You need to get the consent of the mother. Anything you do that changes what you're doing for an abortion, it can only be done if it's in the mother's health or safety. You don't do it to get tissue. Then you're swinging something else ahead of why you're doing the procedure. So I am bothered by the tapes. I know some of my liberal friends are going to say, you know, well, you're getting on the bandwagon of the critics. Well, so be it. I think if you're going to procure a fetal tissue, you got to do it properly. And those tapes are disturbing.
Do you think, I mentioned the physician that's having lunch and swilling wine and discussing these things, which is hard to imagine discussing while you're eating and drinking. Should she get fired?
Not yet. Nope.
No, should she? Should she?
Oh, should she? Yeah, I would. I think it's too cavalier and too irresponsible. But I blame the organization for not setting it up to say, look, if you want to get tissue from us, you meet us at the office. Here's our lawyer. This is what we do. This is standard practice. We don't go out to lunch with different organizations and kind of barter the fee and talk about what we might do for you as opposed to what we might do for them. That's not the way to do this. In fact, I'll go further and be super provocative. I think Planned Parenthood should get out of this whole area. I think we could import fetal tissue from other places. There are fetal tissues that are available sometimes at hospitals. When a fetus is aborted or spontaneously aborts in a few rare cases, I don't know that they should be in the, if that's the best they can do, I think they're causing themselves a lot of harm. And while fetal tissue research is important, it's not hugely important because almost everybody has moved over to working with adult and embryonic stem cells. That became the replacement for fetal tissue. So I don't know that the world, or at least the United States, has a huge need for fetal tissue. And if it's going to come at this price and jeopardize the whole organization, boy, I don't know. I'm not sure they should stay in there if they can't do better than that.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. Art, you know, I've had a pile of things to read on my desk for the last week or so, and coincidentally, one of the things that was there was this story in the New York Times, HIPAA's use as code of silence often misinterprets the law. And for those who don't know what HIPAA is, it's the federal regs that are intended to protect patient confidential health info. I met with someone this weekend who was talking about his child who suffers from some sort of mental illness. And the child, child is now an adult. And he told a story about how he attempted not to get information from the healthcare providers for his child, adult child, but rather to give what he considered to be relevant information to those healthcare providers, and at every layer, from the doctor to the medical director and everybody in between, they argued that, I'm sorry, because of HIPAA, we can't have this conversation with you. And he kept saying, let me be clear, I'm not seeking any information about my kid's treatment unless my kid authorizes it. What all I want to do is give you information that I believe is relevant to your treatment of my child. They would never take it. Is that they could, I assume, do that, number one. And number two, when situations like that happen, is that because they just don't understand the law or because people like that don't want to be burdened by having another conversation that they don't want to have?
No, they understand the law, and the law is, I think, wrong. It gets in the way often. So HIPAA is this federal law that says the only people who can see information about you are the people who take care of you and, ironically, the people who bill you. Those are the two groups that can see your information. So family members, when a family member has a mental illness, they're literally not entitled, assuming that person is an adult, to to get involved or contribute information or find out, is this person coming home and is he dangerous or is he suicidal?
Wait a second. Let me stop you there. They can't even contribute information, meaning that parent who I just described can't even provide information. He didn't want any. He just wanted to give some.
And I think the answer is no unless the patient consents, you know, to say,
really?
You can put that in my record, you can put that in my chart. Otherwise, you're having a discussion about their care, and the law basically says no. So Congressman Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania actually has a law in Congress that he has just put in. I think it's called the Mental Health Crisis Act, and it basically would change HIPAA to permit some discussion about family members about the health of individuals who have mental illnesses. And I think that is really reasonable. It makes a lot of sense. You know, I'm going to jump into the real bog here, as long as we're having a day where I'm getting myself in trouble. I think the whole idea of privacy in the healthcare system is dead. I don't think it works. Between people hacking in, between errors, between people who, you know, inadvertently, or people who don't realize that if you're any kind of celebrity, they're going to take a selfie and, you know, post your medical records, like happened to the Giants football player with his blown off finger.
Yeah,
it was up, I think, in 48 hours. I don't think we have much privacy. The only thing I see the HIPAA law doing is it's making it hard for florists to deliver flowers to people because they don't know what room you're in because no one will tell them, you know, private information.
So is this Murphy thing going anywhere? Or is this like everything else in Congress? It's going to be referred to a committee and die.
I'm not sure. I think it could, because I think people realize the absurdity of saying you won't let me participate in my loved one's mental health care. It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, it does seem to me that the law wasn't really intended to cut off input, to cut off a family's ability to try and be a help in the care of a person. And I know there are people out there with mental illness saying, I don't want my family around. My family drove me crazy. They're the cause of my problems. I don't need anybody, you know, talking to them.
Yeah.
But assumedly, there's room here for judgment. The doctor could say, well, you know, it doesn't look like an intact family, or you abused this person. That's why they're having trouble. So we're not going to give you a role in that. I get all the ins and outs of it. But I guess I believe the default should be let the family get involved or a partner get involved, and then let the doctor say no. Mm-hmm. You can't be involved, and here's why. You did something to this person, or you don't have their best interests at heart. Common sense, I think, would do better than the law.
Yeah, and so many people who sent their kids off to college and their kids have a nervous breakdown in their first semester because they can't take it.
Yeah.
There's like nothing they can do. It's just an insane
right,
policy.
Can't get any information.
Yeah.
You don't find out what's going
exactly.
on.
Exactly. You're forced to move into the room.
You know, it makes no sense whatsoever. Just it's a law that's too crude.
We're talking to our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. And Art Kaplan, I thought I'd heard everything.
Yeah, speaking of crude.
Until I heard this. I know we're all obsessed with our phones, and we're texting, and we're calling, and we're checking Facebook all the time. I had no idea that medical personnel were using cell phones, at least some of them, in the operating room. This Atlantic piece, texting from the operating room. I read this and I thought, oh my God, you know, the anesthesiologist is not paying attention and somebody's dead. I mean, is this a big problem?
Oh, sorry, I was looking at an email here.
Ba-dum-bum. Thank you very much.
That's right. He may get in trouble this week, but he still got that Catskills humor going.
That's right.
But anyway,
that's right.
The fact is, again, this is old school versus new school. I think younger people are just used to bringing their iPhone around and taking pictures, and we have to remind them constantly that isn't something you do with patients. That's not something you do with one another. No, you shouldn't actually take a picture of the giant inflamed liver. No, it's not good to show the gory results of a terrible car accident and put it up there and say, man, did you see this? Or this is unbelievable. We try to control that behavior. And there are, in fact, at my school at NYU, we would even penalize somebody. We might make you retake your entire year if you did that kind of thing and put it up online, and that would cost you a lot of money.
Wow.
But it does go on. People, you know, those things are, the ability to take pictures and photos it gets back to my lament about privacy. It's ubiquitous. It's tough to police it. You know, I see too much of the, here's a weird case. Look at the thing growing on this person's head. Those pictures fly around, and you're sort of like, even without identifiers, you're not supposed to put that stuff up.
Why can't, wait a second, if you go to a restaurant or an office, they can block you from being able to use your cell phone and to go on email or text. Why can't operating rooms be no cell zone?
What, some of them
based
are claiming,
on what?
Because some of them are claiming that they can get access to patient information and lab results, et cetera, on the fly. They can just check their cell phone. I think that's a ridiculous argument, but that's what some of them are claiming, correct?
Yeah, and I think the systems are old-fashioned in hospitals. That's part of the answer to Jim's lament. We're not where we should be in terms of handling electronic things. So we're just getting electronic medical records. You know, Charles Dickens' Scrivener has finally been sent to the basement forever, not writing out by hand your chart. We're just getting online electronically, but we're primitive, and too many hospitals are primitive. I don't know that they know how to do what you're talking about, because I think it's a great idea. I'm not sure they're set up yet to do it.
I don't know if either of you said this, just to leave this topic. In the Atlantic story, they talk about patients who died.
Yeah, the anesthesiologist.
Who died while a doctor is texting.
Right here, 2011 in Texas. Anesthesiologist accused of sending text messages and emails while monitoring a patient whose oxygen levels dropped, which the anesthesiologist apparently didn't notice for 20 minutes, and the woman died. Oh, my God.
You know, it's cavalier, oh, you know, just looking at this email, nothing's going on. And every anesthesiologist knows it's like being an airplane pilot. It's basically routine, boring stuff interrupted by unbelievable occasional crises. So you can't let your attention wander. It's just completely inappropriate. You're going to lose your license, if it's up to me, if you do that sort of thing. But also the people, if you will, the attendings, the people who run the surgery, everybody's got to make it clear you can't do this. I'm not even sure why to get back to the suggestion earlier, maybe everybody ought to check their cell phones at the door.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Well, you know, and this story, too, it's old news at this point, but this Atlantic piece does mention it, that the physician took a picture of the late comedian Joan Rivers while she was on the operating table.
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, you read that again, you think, that is just, I mean, that's just horrible.
Right, no selfies. You can't take pictures with the patient. Even if the patient's consent,
selfies,
by the way, no good. They're in a vulnerable environment.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That was very. You think so much of physicians. I mean, to think that a doctor would take a patient's picture on the operating table just really undermines your confidence.
And by the way, I think so much of physicians. We only have a minute left. But, you know, when you read, you ever heard of the publication Laryngoscope or whatever it's called?
Sure.
So yeah. They do this thing, which sort of, you know, you can imagine Homer Simpson going, saying that essentially there are doctors who can be bought, whose testimony can be bought in smoking cases, where they testified that cigarette smoking or the cigarette was not the cause of the cancer. A friend of ours either coined a phrase or wrote a book called Whores of the Court. And it's not just about doctors. It's about expert witnesses who, for a check, will say anything about anything. We know that.
Right.
So
They're out there, and there are people who lost their privileges practicing because of drug abuse or some other malfeasance, and yet they can still show up in court, and it doesn't necessarily come out that the reason they've testified 411 times in trials is because they can't practice anymore. I think the legal system has tried, you know this better than I do, Jim, to vet a little bit more expert witnesses, you know, be tighter, but it's still not where it should be. I'm just amazed that people, you know, sort of put up with the idea that any doctor can testify more or less about anything and be seen as an equal to some highly qualified expert.
But does anybody get sanctioned quickly, Art? Does anybody ever get sanctioned when their testimony is completely a function of discredited science, or is that it's just an unfortunate reality?
They don't. They don't really get sanctioned. They, you know, we believe that the truth will out in the back and forth of the courtroom, and you come in there and use bad science, you know, vaccine issues or whatever it might be, you can get away with it.
What's on the Everyday Ethics podcast this week, Art Kaplan?
Going to go back to our friends at Planned Parenthood, take another look at this issue here, a little bit more about the need for fetal tissue. Is it all that important? That sort of thing. I think, you know, that organization has more tapes, so I have a feeling this story, like maybe Donald Trump's political campaign is going to go on for a while.
We'll forward all the angry email to you directly, Art. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Art Kaplan. Art Kaplan is our medical ethicist. He joins us every Wednesday. He's head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center, and he is the co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast.